trials are trials for one's life, just as all sentences are sentences of death. That is one of Oscar's memorable, if too portentous, lines. But certainly, after 2 years of harassment from Queensberry, and with Bosie's white-faced, raging encouragement, when Oscar instituted his libel action, at which more than a dozen boys were cited as his partners in crime, the suggestive panthers and gilded snakes you'll hear about later, he had taken his first step. Blindly, he set himself as an ox into the shambles, through 3 trials, to be sentenced to 2 years in a world that might well have been the death of him. A world of metal doors and iron bars. A world where hangings and floggings took place. Where oakum was picked, and treadmills walked, and postbags sewn. Where there was malnutrition, and diarrhea, and sleeplessness. With 1 hour of open-air exercise a day, and no conversation allowed. Where one's beautiful hair was cropped. And of course, what one was made to wear was disastrous.
Everything about my tragedy has been lacking in style. Our very dress makes us grotesque. We are the zanies of sorrow. We are clowns whose hearts are broken. On November the 13th, 1895, I was brought down here from London. From 2 o'clock till 2:30, I had to stand on the platform of Clapham Junction in convict dress and handcuffed, for the world to look at. When people saw me, they laughed. Each train as it came up swelled the audience. Nothing could exceed their amusement. That was, of course, before they knew who I was. As soon as they had been informed, they laughed still more. For 30 minutes I stood there in the grey November rain, surrounded by a jeering mob. For a year after that was done to me, I wept every day at the same hour and for the same space of time. That is not such a tragic thing as it possibly sounds to you. To those who are in prison, tears are a part of every day's experience. A day in prison on which one does not weep is a day on which one's heart is hard, not a day in which one's heart is happy. Well, now I am beginning to feel more regret for the people who laughed than for myself. Of course, when they saw me, I was not on my pedestal. I was in the pillory. But it is a very unimaginative nature that only cares for people on their pedestals. A pedestal may be a very unreal thing. A pillory is a terrific reality. And to mock at a soul in pain is a dreadful thing. The Philistine element in life is not the failure to understand art. He is the Philistine who upholds and aids the heavy, cumbrous, blind, mechanical forces of society, and who does not recognize the dynamic force when he meets it, either in a man or a movement. People thought it dreadful of me to have entertained at dinner the evil things of life, and to have found pleasure in their company. But they, from the point of view through which I, as an artist in life, approached them, were delightfully suggestive and stimulating. It was like feasting with panthers. The danger was half the excitement. I used to feel as the snake charmer must when he lures the cobra to stir and spread its hood at his bidding. They were to me the brightest of gilded snakes. Their poison was part of their perfection. I did not know that when they were to strike at me, it was to be at your piping and for your father's pay. I don't feel at all ashamed at having known them. They were intensely interesting. What I do feel ashamed of is the horrible Philistine atmosphere into which you brought me. My business as an artist was with Ariel. You set me to wrestle with Caliban. What is loathsome to me is the memory of interminable visits to the solicitor Humphreys in your company, when in the ghastly glare of a bleak room you and I would sit with serious faces telling serious lies to a bald man till I groaned and yawned with ennui. There is where I found myself after 2 years' friendship with you, right in the centre of Philistia, away from everything that was beautiful or brilliant or wonderful or daring. I used to feel bitterly the irony and ignominy of my position, when in the course of my 3 trials I used to see your father bustling in and out in the hopes of attracting public attention, as if anyone could fail to note the stableman's gait and dress, the bowed legs, the twitching hands, the hanging lower lip, the bestial and half-witted grin. I say in Dorian Gray somewhere that a man cannot be too careful in the choice of his enemies. I little thought that it was by a pariah that I was to be made a pariah myself. And the curious thing to me is that you should have tried to imitate your father in his chief characteristics. I cannot understand why he was to you an exemplar, where he should have been a warning. You used to laugh and sneer at him for retiring from your cousin's house where he was living, in order to write filthy letters to him from a neighbouring hotel. You used to do just the same to me. You constantly lunched with me at some restaurant, sulked or made a scene during luncheon, and then retired to White's Club and wrote me a letter of the foulest character. The only difference between you and your father was that after you had dispatched your letter, you would arrive at my room some hours later, not to apologize, but to know if I had ordered dinner at the Savoy, and if not, why not. Your one idea of life was that whatever you did was to be paid for by someone else. I don't mean merely in the financial sense, but in the broadest, fullest sense of transferred responsibility. You made that your creed. It was very successful as far as it went. You forced me into taking the action because you knew that your father would not attack your life or yourself in any way, and that I would defend both to the utmost and take on my own shoulders whatever would be thrust on me. You were quite right. Your father and I, each from different motives, of course, did exactly as you counted on our doing. The fact is that you were, and are, I suppose still, a typical sentimentalist. For a sentimentalist is simply one who desires to have the luxury of an emotion without paying for it. You think that one can have one's emotions for nothing. One cannot. Even the finest and the most self-sacrificing emotions have to be paid for. Strangely enough, that is what makes them fine. You forced your way into a life too large for you, one whose orbit transcended your power of vision. Your little life of little whims and moods was admirable in its own little sphere. It was admirable at Oxford, where the worst that could happen to you was a reprimand from the dean, and where the highest excitement was Magdalen becoming head of the river. It should have continued in its own sphere after you left Oxford. In yourself, you were all right. You were a very complete specimen of a very modern type. It was simply in reference to me that you were wrong. Your extravagance was not a crime. Youth is always extravagant. It was your forcing me to pay for your extravagances that was disgraceful. Your desire to have a friend with whom you could pass your time from morning to night was charming, but the friend you fastened on should not have been an artist, one to whom your continual presence was as utterly destructive of all beautiful work as it was paralyzing to the creative faculty. There was no harm in your seriously considering that the most perfect way of passing an evening was to have a champagne dinner at the Savoy, a box at a music hall to follow, and a champagne supper at Willis's as a bonne bouche for the end. Heaps of delightful young men in London are of the same opinion. It is not even an eccentricity. It is the qualification for becoming a member of White's. But you had no right to require of me that I should become the purveyor of such pleasures for you. It showed your lack of any real appreciation of my genius. Your quarrel with your father, again, should obviously have remained a question entirely between the two of you. It should have been carried on in a backyard. Such quarrels, I believe, usually are. Your mistake was on insisting on its being played as a tragicomedy on a high stage in history, with the whole world as the audience, and myself as the prize for the victor in the contemptible contest. The fact that your father loathed you, and that you loathed your father, was not a matter of any interest to the English public. Such feelings are very common in English domestic life and should be confined to the place they characterize, the home. The scraps of a banquet grow stale, and the dregs of a bottle are bitter. Someday you have got to realize it, otherwise you may die without having done so, and then what a mean, starved, unimaginative life you would have had. Remember that imagination is the quality that enables one to see things and people in their real as in their ideal relations. Look at your past, face to face. Sit down quietly and consider it. The supreme vice is shallowness. Whatever is realized is right. I am to be released, if all goes well with me, towards the end of May. I will, if I feel able, arrange through Robbie to meet you in some quiet foreign town like Bruges. I hope that our meeting will be what a meeting between you and me should be, after all that has occurred. Remember that I have yet to know you. Perhaps we have yet to know each other.
After his release, Oscar did see Bosie again, many times. But they never regained any happiness they may once have had together. For a while, in a strange reversal, Bosie had money when Oscar had none, and he did give a few pounds now and then. But when Oscar gently asked for more, he was accused of wheedling like an aging tart. Bosie did not make it to Paris to be with Oscar when he died. One cannot but recall those words he wrote some years before. When you are not on your pedestal, you are not interesting. The next time you are ill, I will go away at once. Perhaps I am uncharitable. Certainly he did arrive in time to attend the funeral, and to insist on being chief mourner.
What lies before me is my past. I have got to make myself look on that with different eyes, to make the world look on it with different eyes, to make God look on it with different eyes. This I cannot do by ignoring it or denying it. It can only be done fully by accepting it as an inevitable part of the evolution of my life and character. How far I am away from the true temper of my soul, this letter in its changing, uncertain moods, its scorn and bitterness, its aspirations and its failure to realize those aspirations, shows you quite clearly. But do not forget in what a terrible school I am sitting at my task. And incomplete, imperfect as I am, yet from me you may have still much to gain. You came to me to learn the pleasure of life and the pleasure of art. Perhaps I am chosen to teach you something much more wonderful, the meaning of sorrow and its beauty. Your affectionate friend, Oscar Wilde.